Now, this is someone who had a position in Reagan's administration, was it?
Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration.
She had some high-up role in the in HUD.
Yes.
Which is what, Housing and Urban Development?
Yes.
So she has become authority on economics from the in the fringe world because of her actual bureaucratic experience in this world.
Well, she started out at one of the investment banks.
Investment bank.
Yeah, she worked at one of those. That's where she got her experience. She was very successful, made millions, I think. And then she was involved in politics, where she actually was sued by the government, had to spend quite a few of her millions to defend herself. And then she started her own investment community, which is what she does now.
Well,
right.
She didn't fare very well with Paul Volcker.
In what sense?
Head to head with Mr. Volcker.
When she had an administrative position in the Reagan period?
Yep.
Do you admire what Catherine did, or was she misguided?
Well, she's still kicking. We.
No. I mean, what did she have a point in relation to Volcker?
Yeah. She went head to head and said, "Come on, big boy, let's pee. See who can pee hardest again the ground."
What was the particular thing that she objected to?
HUD ones.
HUD ones. O-N-E-S?
Yeah. A HUD number one, yes. It's the mortgage documentation that has to be done with every URLA or 1003 that's filled out.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of her you have to do that.
And Volcker objected to that?
Well, of course, you're having to disclose with a HUD one what kind of financing or loan or paper this was. And up until then, it had never been done. It was either FHA, VA, or conventional. Well, now you had a HUD one that had to be done and a URLA, Universal Residential Lending application, that cleared it up and segregated it all out. That's where it went awry.
And that application or form you filled out, that...
Still fill out.
That made the books more visible, so
yep.
Didn't manip- And Volcker objected to that.
Absolutely, because he's trying to dig himself out of the Carter administration.
Right, so there were certain financial problems on a secret level that Volcker could get out of if her bureaucratic meddling did not confuse the getting out of the rabbit hole.
Correct.
Right, well, that's fair. Now, have you done any thinking about Catherine Austin Fitz before today?
Who?
Ion, you. Did you do any?
Yeah.
Yeah, here's an interesting point, Ed. We bring up Catherine Austin Fitz, then Ion brings up the file right away for itself, and is an instant expert on it. Right? You've never thought of her before the moment we brought this topic up 5 minutes ago.
Never once.
So, Ed, I don't know how much of Fitz you've heard, but any of this talk we just heard from Ion, did you ever hear her discuss the HUD one document?
I hadn't heard her describe it in that way, or with Paul Volcker.
Okay, so let's
but
hear
she was
this.
All about transparency. That was her problem in HUD. She was revealing the dirty tricks, she would have said, HUD was up to, and that's when they
began. That was why you fill them out now.
Mm-hmm.
That was the point.
Right, and from Paul Volcker's view, he might have been correct to not have that paper meddling, because you might have been to get out of the bind of the debts to China and all that stuff of the 70s, might have been able to clear the books better if you didn't have this meddling that Fitz brought
in. It wasn't about the books, Bob. It was trying to run the Federal Reserve, which was the clearinghouse for the banks that were creating the money that she was aware how they did it, was saying make it to where it's clear, so if you're going to get screwed, at least you can have the lights on long enough to see what's going to screw you. And he was like, no, we need to do this intercourse and in the dark.
Because He would say that because we're already in a bad position. Let's try to get out of this. He proposed that when America could get out of it, or the Federal Reserve could get out of it, if they followed his way, we look back, would he have gotten out of it if it went his way? And if we said yes, then maybe he was right.
Of course, because where do you think that what got you out of it was the Star Wars spending? That there's no way you, it's like an old-timey church social. We're going to eat our way out of debt.
And so was Volcker keen on the Star Wars method of getting out of it?
He didn't care, but it was the only way you could double it up enough to cover your shorts.
Right. So he was all for let's cover up and somehow fix the book so we look like we got out of it. And
well, Bob, I mean, those are the days when a loan cost you 15%.
Right. But if people felt bad today and did not like the economic cataclysms happening today, in retrospect, they might say, well, yeah, if we'd follow Volcker's way, we'd get out of it. But you, Ion, would say, no, you're all for this crash because it means you're no longer dependent on any of these positions, either from Catherine's point or from Volcker's
point. You're going to be liberated from the salamander people. Hooray.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here we go.
I was a partner and member of the board of Dillon Reed, which was a Wall Street firm. And in 1989, I left Wall Street to become Assistant Secretary of Housing in the first Bush administration. And then when I left, started a investment bank in Washington, the Hamilton Securities Group. It was very much focused on helping private investors work with communities to re-engineer how the flow of investment capital worked in communities in a way that would significantly build up small business, small farms. It's a little bit of investment model behind decentralization or what some people call localization. And that was very successful, but one of the things we were doing was bringing transparency to how government money and credit worked in communities. And what that did was illuminate tremendous amounts of fraud in the mortgage securities and the mortgage financing in the United States. And as a result, we were targeted in a process that turned into 11 years of litigation with the federal government. And that, you know, I was a financial person who was always very invisible and behind the scenes. And that brought me into a situation where the only way I could resolve the litigation successfully was to bring transparency, not just to my situation, but what sort of the corruption in the mortgage markets and in the financial markets. And so I ended up launching two companies. One is Solari Inc., which really brings, we're trying to help families and individuals protect wealth in a situation where it's we're dealing with more and more sort of government corruption. And then the other is Solari Investment Advisors. I work as an investment advisor to individuals and families. And so my history has been one of trying to help people who want to be free and want to be financially secure and want to live in wonderful communities, try and navigate an environment where here in the United States it's increasingly more difficult to do.
Yes.
When I try to understand what's going on around me, whether it's in my community, whether it's in my state, whether it's here in North America, whether it's globally, what I try and do is I map what's happening financially and economically around events and ask the question, who benefits?
Yes.
You know, qui bono? Who wins? Who loses? Why? Because so much of our world and our economy is driven by covert events or manipulations which are, for a variety of reasons, invisible. I mean, having worked at high levels on Wall Street in Washington, the most planning and governance of the resources in our world is done quietly, and it's done behind the scenes, not in a way, I'm saying, not necessarily in a way that's improper. It's just the way currently it works. So when I now my also my experience on Wall Street in Washington is the last place to learn about what's going on is in the newspaper,
yeah.
or certainly in the corporate media. The corporate media is there to push its agenda, but it's not a source of information about what's really going on. And so, whenever I hear of events that are important, impact me, impact my network, I publish something called the Soleri Report, Impact My Subscribers. The first thing I do is I map out the financial ecosystems around the event to try and see who wins and who loses and help discern what's going on. Well, if you map the financial ecosystems around the economy in America for the last, well, we'll focus on the last 20 years, we've had an economy which I call is the slow burn. And in a slow burn, the insiders basically use a variety of different force, both visible and invisible, to subsidize themselves with the monies and the resources of the outsiders. It's kind of a one expression I have for it is the tapeworm economy. The way a tapeworm works in your body, it injects in you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're literally, you know, the body politic has a tapeworm, and that tapeworm is getting more and more expensive. And what you'll see with this sort of slow burn economy is every time you get to the point where financial assets should fall in value, so the stock market should fall in value or bond prices should fall in value, rather than have that happen, we have an event. So coming into September 11, 2001, you had all sorts of people in the financial world predicting, oh, the market's going to crash, the jig is up, and instead of that happening, we had September 11th, and suddenly the Fed was able and the Treasury were able to intervene massively in the economy,
yes.
in a way that kept the financial paper invaluable.
Hmm.
What we've seen steadily is it's like a body that's on steroids, and we keep getting these injections of events. And and coming into this September, we were seeing the same pattern. The economy was unemployment in the United States is skyrocketing. The boomers, as they age, are being told that their pension funds, their 401ks, the Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all these things they were counting on are being lost or cut. And you looked at this fall and you said, oh, well, something has to, you know, give.
Yeah.
We're either going to get real, you know, another round of tremendous crashes in the economy, or we're going to have another one of these, you know, 9/11, war in Afghanistan, war in Iraq. We need a big event. And it was just then. So the financial ecosystems are flashing warning, 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 event, big event coming, big event needed if we're going to continue to, if the tapeworm's going to continue to extract another round of subsidy. You know, hungry tapeworm on the prowl, and then suddenly the swine flu started to circulate and the idea of having a mandatory vaccine.
And I also want to add this to the mix here, so to speak, that major pharmaceutical companies are now reporting already that they're going to make major profits with these vaccination programs like Merck, Novartis, Baxter, GlaxoSmithKline, and others. What do you think that says about the current state of things?
Well, when you get an economy, we are on a planet that does not have an economic problem. We have a political problem.
I'm glad you stopped. I was just wondering at this point about time, would you have a comment? Are you enjoying this?
Well, this has been the most logical, progressive conversation that you've had. It's very, very logical, progressive, and insightful. Now, we have a few little words that we want to clean up that I think she didn't mean that way. When she was talking about how the 911 had to keep, the government would have more engagement to keep those bonds invaluable or those securities invaluable, we take deference there because they were trying to prop it up to give an approach or breached false sense of value. So So if she's using it that way, then they are invaluable, okay? But that's the twist. If that's the way she's using it, okay, fine.
You like the logic of her?
Yes, it's progressive, it's interactive, and it's illuminating. That everything she's saying is coming into a place where you can have some change of coming into a place of power. Individually.
That's right.
It's fabulous.
Yeah, now, she's saying the government would do an event like 911 to keep the economy or to keep, you know, the crisis, to create jobs or create something.
Lots of money, lots of business in war, Bob.
Right, and you're saying that in reference to the bond, they actually did 911 to destroy the bonds, not keep them going.
Right, and that's what she said, invaluable. And that's why we took deference with the way, did she mean invaluable in the correct tense, or was it a little faux pas? So that's
right.
Why we brought up about the keeping the bond values and the stock prices invaluable.
Okay, well, do you agree with her thesis that every major event like swine flu comes along to keep the government viable, or whatever she's saying is preserved?
Yes, she left out the biggest ringleader of it was Pfizer. The drug companies.
For the swine flu event.
For all of them, but Pfizer. White, she got most of them, but she left out Pfizer and White.
But is Pfizer and White relate to 911?
They do.
Well, what's the inventory of events of the last 50 years? Korean War would be one, right?
Well, that wasn't a war, that was a conflict.
Okay, the Korean conflict would help Pfizer?
Yes, of course.
Vietnam War helped Pfizer?
Absolutely.
Watergate helped Pfizer?
No, but it did bring deregulation that let them do any crazy thing they wanted to do.
Right, and that was under the guise of cleaning up the CIA.
Well, taking out the restrictions, they made everybody who wasn't, we're using Pfizer, but we're including all of them. What Watergate did was made them a god unto themselves, meaning they only police themselves. So the AMA is when they were really kicked in gear in that flow, that everyone else could be put in jail if they went against the drug companies.
Right, and that's
or,
like...
Or sacrifice your license if you say one thing out of the way to uncover their tomfoolery.
Right, and that's Aldous Huxley's Brave New World shows a world that's controlled by the drug Soma, I think. That is a good metaphor. That book was written like in the 30s, so that's a good metaphor of what happens by the 70s with Pfizer.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Soma perpetrators. So I'm saying that he projected a society run, controlled by through Soma, which was a good projection of what by the 70s, Pfizer and White, is it? White, W-Y-T-H?
White.
Yeah, W-Y-T-H?
Mm-hmm. White.
Okay. Pfizer and White, they provided the global Soma, or the different kinds of Soma, the deregulation of the distribution of it, is a major causality from Watergate to what would be next. The removal of the Ayatollah, or the removal of the Shah, would that be connected
mm-hmm.
to Pfizer?
Shah, well... Now, you're doing a bit of a stretch, but you're correct in the way you're flowing it, but it's including the drug world. That's just a subset. But it affected other things, too. But what had to happen is the AMA had to get some teeth to be able to disbar anybody, any health provider, who went outside what the medical drug companies were saying.
And that was the key, deeply political, you'd have the phrase deep politics, that was the real power authority issue that would be important from the 70s on up to now.
Mm-hmm.
And
Canada wasn't having all that, so you go to Canada and get a drug that costs you $1,000 here and go there and get it for $40 U.S.
Right, but the point is that the real power struggle for the global theater was around the medicinal application of therapy.
The medicinal, no, not a therapy, of who had final say.
So the drug companies were the new Rothschilds, the new Rockefellers, whatever, the new Illuminati, this projection people have of someone in control. It was their causality that was the real fulcrum of power and authority.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so
a fulcrum.
Right. But you're saying the prime fulcrum for keeping the flow of cash through the Federal Reserve.
Yeah.
Cash flow.
That's a show.
As a show, right. You know, McLuhan would say, you know, the computerization of society in the 60s led to this virtual economy that moved pretty fast. You needed to drug the population to keep them functioning as zombies at the speed that was coming in the 70s, 80s, 90s. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and they're still being drug around.
Yeah, drug around. Okay, so then you move up all the major events. I mean, what, you had Iraqgate, you had the, what was that bank, BCCI, anything with the economy or any economic transaction that dripped blood, the ground of that was Pfizer and Weiss.
Not just them, Merck. She listed them all. She just left out Pfizer and Weiss. We were adding them to her list.
Yeah, so then you come into 911, Pfizer and Weiss. Well, that's a new thing, a new exclusive. Ed, call this session Pfizer and Weiss.
Bob, we're going to say this 11 more times. She listed a bunch of drug companies, all the majors, but she left out Pfizer and Weiss. We were adding it to her list. They weren't any less involved than Merck. She just didn't list them.
Right, so AMA is the icon for all of them.
AMA is nothing. AMA is just the sheriff that's supposed to keep the power in the place of the drug companies. That's all.
Okay, so what would Ed, if you took excerpt of this section, what is the title for drug, you know, pharmacotopia? I mean, what is the larger term to cover the syndrome you're just explaining? The power in the drug companies.
You're talking the pillars of society.
The pillars. Okay, very good.
And
yeah,
the song that would go along with that would be called 10,000 Years.
The one you were talking, yeah. And that would be pillars, P-I-L-E-R-S, Ed.
Right, P-I-L-L-E-R-S.
Yeah, rather than A-R-S. Okay, so, okay, let's carry on.
And, you know, think of this as many years ago when you had these huge dinosaurs roaming the world, and they basically destroyed their financial or their ecosystem because the planet couldn't support, you know, animals that hungry and that big. So we have a similar situation with big corporations that are, we've built up, for example, in the healthcare industry, tremendous industry overhead that we can't afford. It was built up as a result of massive amounts of government debt, and it's not economic when you said, if you were just going to devise a health system to optimize living well-being of all the people, the current system is not economic. And part of that industry overhead is these huge corporations making significant amount of drugs and selling them for way above cost. So you've got corporations, they need, you know, they're a tapeworm, they need to be fed. And yes, they're going to make a tremendous amount of money, including because here in the United States, the federal government has waived all their liabilities. So they have absolutely no liability on this thing, is my understanding. Now, but I don't think the goal here is to make money, because usually what happens in decision making at this level, you know, where you're going to, you know, where people are going to decide to have a vaccination worldwide, is a group of people get together thinking strategically and decide where they want to go. And so then the next decision is, okay, now that we know we want to go to this place, how can we organize it so all the organizations we need to get to that place make money?
Yeah.
And so you know, the making of the money is not the strategic goal. It's the thing that makes accomplishing that strategic goal financially sustainable. So yes, I think it's been designed so it'll be very attractive for the drug companies to execute, and will continue to subsidize that part of the tapeworm. But I don't think making money is the goal on this thing. I think, you know, who knows? There could be many, many different goals, but I think none of them are good for the people who take the vaccination.
Oh, I guess he's talking about the vaccination program is not to make money. Maybe that's what you mean.
Well, no, that's to infiltrate the whole process. But the whole thing of it is if the shareholders of those drug companies listen to her, you ought to go sell your stock.
Right. Okay, so
they're
what...
They're not doing it for your health. They're doing it for their bottom line.
Okay, and what is she trying to say? Let's try to find out the usefulness of her point.
Well, she's trying to draw extrapolate the dupedness of what the federal government has allowed them to have free reign and control of any provider who doesn't want to play by the AMA rules, which is AKA the drug company rules. That's why medicine is all changed now. You don't go to the doctor to get well-being, as she said. You go to the doctor to get a prescription.
Right. But that's to make money. But what is the point she's trying to make when she says it's not to make, the goal is not to make money? What do you think she's correct about?
Keep you sick. The point is, the drug company in that point context could say, we're not in this for the money. We're in this to keep you sick. Because if we keep you sick, then every step along the way, if we decide we're going to go there, then we're going to make money every step of the way.
Yeah, if we're going to decide to go there, if we are working towards that to make you sick, and we're going to make money on the way.
And if the HIV drugs didn't cost $1,000 a month, Bob, there'd be no HIV.
Now, the creators, human creators created... Human beings, citizens created HIV.
Yes, and they also, and now all of a sudden, if you got HIV, you were dead. It was over. Might as well be leprosy. Then all of a sudden, human creators like, the hell with this noise, I'm hanging around. And then people all of a sudden magically quit dying. Nobody dies of HIV anymore.
Okay.
Another thing I was thinking about here, recently came out a news item about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that they actually sold their total holding of about 2.5 million shares in various healthcare companies and so forth, and they bought shares, I think, in telecom and energy or whatever. But do you think that's significant or not? Does that say anything about what's on the radar as well, or is that just are they trying to run us down a detour here? What do you think?
I mean, the Gates Foundation is interesting, one of the reasons it's interesting is it really does show up the truth behind the philanthropic model here in the United States. You sweep a whole bunch of capital into an endowment, and that endowment doesn't have to pay taxes because it's supposedly for good works. So let's say it would pay taxes of 10% or 15% on its capital gains, but let's say based on the current principal and investment policy, it would have to pay taxes of 8% a year. Instead of paying taxes of 8% a year, we instead put it in a foundation, and then it gives the foundation 5% a year, so we avoid, you know, we basically save 3% a year. And what we do with the money that's in the endowment is we use it to finance the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
Okay, and so it provides cheaper capital for the military-industrial complex, and then we use our 5% to do a series of things which promote where we want to go and the people we want to manage and the things we want to do, and it also takes all the people concerned with what the military-industrial complex is doing and channels them in a way that keeps them very busy and out of our hair.
Hmm.
And it's quite economic because it lowers the cost of capital to the military-industrial complex, and it takes the money we would have paid to pay taxes and government service and serves a whole variety of different agendas which serve our purpose.
Yeah.
And so there was a marvelous series that the Los Angeles Times did about the Gates Foundation financing the corporations that were destroying the environment in a place in Africa while the Gates Foundation was going in with a grant and saying, we are here to help you.
Exactly.
And pointing out the, but, you know, not to pick on the Gates Foundation, because you'll, throughout American philanthropy, you will see the same model. The universities here have been used as major ways of pooling capital for a variety of purposes. And when you look at what the university endowments are really doing and what's really going on, versus the notion that they would have tax shelter to basically, you know, plunder and destroy the world is quite amazing. There's a wonderful series of articles and transparency around the involvement of the Harvard Endowment in helping to basically rape Russia during the 90s, and there was even litigation around it. And, you know, it just goes to show you why in the world should we give a tax exemption to a university, which is really an air cover for an investment syndicate that is basically running around and killing people.
Huh. Why doesn't we, you know, why don't we begin to phase out oil, for instance, and begin to, you know, invest in new types of energy? I mean, I think that there's a whole new industry that eventually this is going to pop up, but if right now it feels like we're in this rut, as you say, in between two different worlds almost. And
it's like we are between two worlds right now. And we go, imagine that. Yes. And then all this foundation stuff, that's not new. You've done, Bob, you've probably heard more hours on foundations than anybody else on the planet regarding of why they have it. Well, here's why they're not going to stop it or not going to quit it. Because of all your politicians are well vested in these foundational trusts so that they don't have to pay taxes. So they're not going to do away with those, because then the politicians had to pay taxes. If Obama had to pay taxes on the $100+ million he took to get a job that pays $450,000 to $500,000 a year, they wouldn't run. That was income. Why isn't it taxed?
Right, so the antidote is to ignore the elections, ignore the government, or bring in a party that would dismantle as much as possible. That's the way to engage, to get out of this less-than situation.
Mm-hmm. Let the lizard people do it. They don't require money. Oh, wait, what he said was happening. Well, then why are you paying lizard people? They don't require money.
Yeah, and why complain that they are running it?
Exactly. It's your problem, you pay for it. Okay.
They're just the janitors, so let them be the janitors. So, but so what? She uses the phrase military-industrial complex. You have no problem with that?
It's just they're not using foundational money to pay for military campaigns. They're using military campaigns so that they can be the philanthropy that comes in and makes the capital off. They'll pay for the tanks and make money off selling the government tanks, and then they can come in and give them help and resuscitate the economy for a tax dodge.
But in that
the
sentence,
other way around.
In that sentence, who was they? The Pentagon? The corporation?
We have no idea. That's the they. That's that. Anonymous.
That's what she was saying.
Right, they.
Oh, I thought you were saying an idea that you believed in or advocated.
No, we were. We just straightened out the flow of what she was trying to convey.
And it leads to an anomaly.
End of the day, here's what the deal is. Vanderbilts, they came along, okay? Vanderbilts were into shipping, okay?
Mm.
That was their thing, and timber, okay? So they, Vanderbilts, then massed up this huge amount of money, not so they could be wealthy, so they could get more ships, get more timber, cut more trees. When they got more trees, then they had more timber, and they had more ships, and they had more shipping. So they didn't do it because they were rich. They got rich because they did it, which is the way you're supposed to do it. Carnegie, or pick one, Steele, J.P. Morgan. They didn't do it to make money. They did it to make Steele, because if they made Steele, they'd get money. Steele was more important than money. They already had money. That's what she's trying to say about the drug companies in retrospect.
It's not about making money. They're making drugs.
It's about making and control of making everybody have to have it.
Yes, well, Steele or timber or whatever other products you mentioned or drugs, that's what McClellan meant by the medium. That's new technology.
And that's what she's saying. And they've been given license to rape and pillage the world, which is a stretch, because all that's happened is they've come into their place of power and they're like, this is my world and I'll do with it just exactly what I happy damn well please. And I'll whoop the man. I'll sick the salamanders on anybody who says it isn't so.
Yeah, so they're wearing the whole world, which is wearing the whole universe, is their position of power, which everyone should take.
We find it very interesting that a handful of dinosaurs, that wasn't enough, there wasn't enough earth to sustain them, but yet you've got room for 6, 7, 8, 9 billion people to survive and get drugs. They couldn't make enough food to feed the dinosaurs, but they can make enough Cipro to feed the masses.
So the dinosaurs did not get phased out for the reason that everybody accepts.
No, they did. We just find it odd that there wasn't enough food for the dinosaurs of that size, and there weren't that many. But you have as many billions of people as you have on the planet now, and there's drugs available for everybody.
Yeah, but that's man-made products. The dinosaurs had no man-made products to feed off. So why did the dinosaurs...
They didn't have a military to sustain either, Bob.
Did the dinosaurs become extinct?
They haven't yet.
They're still around through their DNA?
No, they're coming.
Oh, they haven't happened yet.
They're coming.
A lot of what we think is in the past, you project it hasn't happened, like Atlantis, and that is viable if you accept there's no time.
Right.
And if there's no time, then things that we thought happened in the past.
You got little bitty versions of things coming along in what you call evolving. You had little bitty things that are turning into crocodiles that are turning into bigger things. And they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And you go, but Ion, they found bones of the velociraptors, and they found bones of stegosauruses, and they have found the remains frozen, the Tyrannosaurus rexes and all this kind of stuff. And we go, yes, 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 that's exactly right. They've also found the compass in Tutankhamun's tomb.
Right, so we find things from the future in the tombs, and we find aspects of the dinosaurs, but they've been planted from the future.
And they're coming, they're arriving. So you'll recognize what they are when they get here.
Right, so because our perception is like that, we have to have a reference point just to see anything.
Looking for a reason,
A reference point from previous experience. So you're saying that there was no extinction of dinosaurs because they didn't get here, but if we think that the rats and that or whatever evolved in the dinosaurs and then we figure they're gone, we got it wrong. They are going to evolve from the creatures we have today into the huge dinosaurs. That's a progression, and that's coming. And if we don't accept they're coming, we think they're past, then we have to come up with the idea that they've been made extinct. But they haven't. They weren't.
Exactly. Because they didn't.
How's that for an exclusive, Ed? The dinosaurs that haven't happened yet. So Catherine Austin Fitz, it's okay. You like the way she's staying on the...
We think it's beautiful, and we think it's pointed, and we think the flow of the... There's no gobbledygook in this. It's very on point. And now there are some stretches, granted, but we have no issue. It's been pretty fluid and full of getting you on the ledge of knowing.
Okay.
Well, if you look at control, let's just step back and look at control from the point of view. Let's just invent a character called Mr. Global. And it's Mr. Global's job to manage the planet and manage all resources on the planet. And let's look at things from Mr. Global's point of view. Mr. Global, from what we can tell, wants control.
Now, Ian, you would say you got no problem with Mr. Global taking his power.
Yeah, he is, whether you like it or not. That's individual human creators coming into their place of power.
And the only way
they don't care what you think about what they do.
Yeah, and the only way you could, if you thought you wanted to best them or something, is to come into your own power and go global yourself.
Well, and see, you notice how she's being very careful with Mr. Global, not saying Mr. Authority, who says he's going to manage the world. This is who is managing the world's resources. Good.
And the goal is control, not money, because we know if we just said, look, we want to optimize total wealth on planet Earth, and total wealth would be 100% fully optimized, my bet on how much wealth exists on planet Earth is less than 1% of that.
Mm.
Not getting that. What's less than 1%?
If you went at a full out, 100%, and you're not at 100%, if you were 100% of how much money you think is, if you were at maximum capacity, that the real amount of money would be less than 1% of that figure. She's been listening to cash flow, Bob.
Okay, I don't. You're saying is she saying that the actual physical wealth is way more than any peg, price tag?
No, it's 1% of it.
What is 1%? The amount of money.
The amount of money it is would be less than 1% of that amount.
I'm not getting the one amount of money that is. What is
Bob?
Where are we? Let's begin. What's square one? Where are we beginning with of this sentence? What are we trying to say?
Go back just a tiny little bit and listen to what she says.
And the goal is control, not money, because we know if we just said, look, we want to optimize total wealth on planet Earth, and total wealth would be 100% fully optimized, my bet on how much wealth exists on planet Earth is less than 1% of that.
Mm.
Okay, Mr. Global, this thing, you said it was a dollar, but then it becomes a penny? You see,
that's what she's saying.
Are you okay? We have all the environment's technological wealth. Then to say it's something equal to, if it's equal to something in dollar terms, is missing the point. Dollar doesn't measure the wealth that it is. Is that what you're saying? The actual wealth?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Less than that.
What is less than that?
The dollar. The value.
Yeah, the dollar is the wealth of our actual physical creations.
Is nothing.
And that's worth, that nothing is more powerful than any cent or penny or dollar you tag onto it.
Of course.
It's worth nothing, and that's good that it's worth nothing. If you start saying it's involved with cash or money, then you get all tangled up and think you don't have any.
Exactly, which is why you are now.
Right, so no, you know, this is what LaRouche says, what Alan Watts says, you know, we put the financial oligarchy projects money onto the wealth that we have, and that's what screws everybody up. And so with the way she says it, why did she say it's worth more than not as much as worth? Why complicate it the way she says it?
Because she's trying to get you to get the notion that all these big corporations that you think they're just after the money, they're not interested in money at all. They're interested, Mr. Global's only interested in control
of the technologies that happen. He
of
wants
the
to
resources.
And also, yeah, and to determine which resources are available.
To the masses.
Yeah, right. To the masses.
Because, see, your Apple could give a shit if they sell a phone. They want to sell apps.
Yeah, and it's a schizophrenia, called the societal schizophrenia caused by the printing press that emphasizes finance and accounting books as opposed to the wealth that happens every day in people's lives watching stuff on the computer for free.
Well, it ain't for free. You got to have an IP provider.
Yeah, you pay a little bit, but the point is the wealth
a little bit to get
No, don't get distracted. Look, the wealth of experience that people experience every day is immeasurable. Cannot be called, I had $400 worth of YouTubes today. You know what I mean? You just had all the stuff that you did and watched and then typed with. The finance, the schizophrenic printed press currency label that's attached to everything is what Catherine is complaining about.
Pointing out.
Okay, let's see what she says.
And if you look at, well, why is it less than 1% of, you know, of what could be 100%? It's because it's designed for control. It's not designed to optimize wealth.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then what Mr. Global wants is control. Now, one of the chief ways that Mr. Global controls is by controlling the currencies. Okay?
Mm.
If you can control the currency and the monetary policy of a planet, you can control that planet. And
see, that's what's odd. The Mr. Global wants to control the resources and determine which ones are used, but it's interpreted that he can do that if he has a lot of cash.
Right, and that has nothing to do with it.
But he does. Isn't he controlled a bit by that fact? Or
No.
I think he gets caught in the middle. Between two worlds, he has to look like he owns a lot cash-wise, so he's allowed to appear authoritative in controlling the resources, telling where they go. Or there's an understanding on the higher levels of power that the money thing is ignored, which is what was shown with Enron and all that. They ignored the money point.
Right.
We'll just move forward here.
And let's look at things from Mr. Global's point of view. Mr. Global, from what we can tell, wants control.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And the goal is control, not money, because we know if we just said, look, we want to optimize total wealth on planet Earth, and total wealth would be 100% fully optimized, my bet on how much wealth exists on planet Earth is less than 1% of that.
And those last 25 words, she shifted the meaning of wealth to money.
Mm-hmm. But she's saying that. Yes, and that's right. And that's the point. You can't make it be about the money. Because
right.
If it's about the money, there's not enough money. That's how you have these debts, this national debt, that already is more than money is.
That's right. And so just the way she said it, you know, I would say it more precisely. Like, I would indicate now I'm shifting to the monetary printed press version of definition of wealth. And that is not equal to the actual technological total artifacts we have. It cannot match.
Well, and it doesn't match what your government says money is. Money in circulation is supposed to be the GMP. Well, it's not that either. So now, guess what? You and James, you take credit for crashing the economy, but come to find out the thing you crashed didn't have any value anyway.
Yeah, that's what I knew. I don't know if James understood that. I knew that because I pointed out that we weren't going to successfully finally crash it because the money crash would not.
Because
we just had to keep typing, which is my way of saying
it.
Yeah, no, when I say keep typing, that means, or clicking, that means engaging in the wealth that's there regardless of what it costs financially.
Right.
So it didn't matter. So I predicted the neo-recovery or whatever it is. We're still in that situation, though we have come to a new situation where nobody knows what's technological valuable wealth anymore. See, there's the new level. There's so many different levels of wealth, including parallel world traveling, that obsolesces the hardware wealth. And so with that potential, nobody knows
what... The poor people don't no longer require money to survive, and the rich people don't know what can't keep the money they got. So there you go.
They don't know what can't keep. They don't know what can keep the money. They don't know what can't keep.
Right.
Oh, they don't want to keep the money. That's right. They want to keep it flowing.
And they want to give it away.
They're stuck with me.
They're stuck
with something. Yeah. They're stuck with money that people don't require.
That's right. So it's no good to be a billionaire if everybody's giving it away for free.
And that's a pop song for the masses that actually, if they knew what they're doing, it would be a good satire on being a billionaire. But most people will think, I want to get a lot of money. It's a popular song for the mass mind right when being a billionaire is not significant anymore.
Well, and now it takes $1 billion to get anybody's attention. Used to, if you were a millionaire, you were the it. If you had $100,000 in the 70s, you were a fat cat, Bob. Now it takes $1 billion to get anybody's attention.
But we've come to the point where that's moot. You can't even get attention with that.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Very good. All right, now roll.
And if you look at, well, why is it less than 1% of, you know, of what could be 100%? It's because it's designed for control. It's not designed to optimize wealth.
What's not designed to optimize wealth? What's her point there? Which wealth, which meaning?
The system.
The financial illusion is not designed to optimize. Yeah, it doesn't optimize. And that whole dilemma, which has been going on for most of the 20th century, you could say, has finally caught up to the guys who thought they didn't have to tell anybody that truism.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have to, and they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So then what Mr. Global wants is control. Now, one of the chief ways that Mr. Global controls is by controlling the currencies. Okay?
Mm.
If you can control the currency and the monetary policy of a planet, you can control that planet, and pretty invisibly. But to control the currency, you need to be able to control and make sure that the critical assets are traded in that currency.
Now, isn't to control the currencies is to control the perception that money is valuable or not, and they don't want
They want to make sure that you have all the basic needs are traded in the currency you're trying to control, and that's where they've jumped off the wagon. See, they've fallen off the wagon. And what she's saying is that if you're going to control the currency, you better make damn sure that water and food and air and gold are traded in the currency that you're trying to control.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying they are trapped by the money illusion. They don't believe in it, but they have to control and pretend it's significant, the currency trade, so that people don't know that money is not important and currencies aren't important. Isn't
but
that what
people are finding it out because they're not making their house payments and they're still in their houses?
Because it's the end.
Why are you going to make a payment on a house when you can live in the house for free?
It's the end of time and the end of the illusion of money. And the more
it's
we point that out,
the end of the world as we know it. As you song it, it's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine. Good.
It's the end of the currencies.
Yes.
As we're the first the dollar, then the euro. Okay, so, I guess we're on the same channel on that, okay?
You are. Very good, Bob. Your green drink's working.
Yes.
And to date, that critical asset has been oil.
Yeah.
Now, we know that the powers that be, or they certainly appear, to want to move to a one-world virtual currency. And if you're going to, and that's ultimate, I mean, talk about ultimate control. One world virtual currency is control, because a virtual currency will allow you to control the data.
Ah, right.
That's right. And
you knew it was going to get there. You do that, Lindy, a little bit.
Well, McLuhan pointed out that that everybody's involved in the global exchange of data. But the elites control the large-scale interpretations of the data functions or the data involvement, and that's exactly what she's been saying. The Mr. Global wants to control the definition of the role of currencies.
The definition of what currency applies to.
Right, right.
Good.
And,
see, this is why can't we have more of these, Bob? At least she is saying something.
Well, as McLuhan used to say, even Hercules had to clean the Aegean stables, but only
absolutely.
Once.
Absolutely. Only
so
one.
We cleaned it. We cleaned the bullshit is bullshit. What's that? Bullshit. What is he saying?
No, I'm not saying what you're saying is bullshit. I'm just saying that bullshit is bullshit. Because bullshit is bullshit. Now, what you were saying would fit into that same vernacular. But I wasn't saying that what you were saying was bullshit. Yeah, no, I wasn't saying that. I wasn't saying that. No, yeah, right. Yes, no, okay. Well, it's always a bunch of bullshit on the hoodie. Put it on mute. Put it on mute. Yeah, I did. It's bullshit now. It's very interesting that you'd bring that up. I was just thinking about bullshit. Yeah, there you go.
I like what Cat Beefheart said. You don't need to get into the bullshit to find out what the bull ate.
Right. That's exactly right.
To do that. It's bullshit trying to not do that. You can't help but get into the bullshit. It's like Ed. He doesn't have anything to say, but he's putting out a lot of tellings every day. He just shovels the bullshit.
And Leverly.
Yeah, Leverly. Mm-hmm. He and Mr. Wilbur. Or was it Wilbur? Wilbur, Mr. Ed. Okay. Yeah, your medium, Ed, is Wilbur. Wait a minute. Wait, no, Ed. Is Wilbur the horse?
No, Mr. Ed.
Yeah,
Mr.
Ed. That's right.
Mr.
He is a horse.
Ed is the horse. Wilbur is the one he's speaking to. He's the one being told things.
All right, so Wilbur is the audience.
Wilbur.
And, yeah, Wilbur is the audience that's being told all the stuff that Ed's putting out. But Ed is the horse that's laughing at those.
Yeah.
He's the horse telling Wilbur, the audience, as if there's something to be said. But the horse knows there ain't nothing to be said, or he ain't saying anything.
Yeah, because a horse is a horse, of course, unless, of course, the mighty horse is staying the course of the famous Mr. Ed. That's where you'll insert the Mr. Ed song then. Boy, this is going to be a long road.
Okay, that's a good one. We're coming to a fine conclusion.
And in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. So how are you going to do that? Well, for a variety of reasons, it doesn't look like oil is going to work. And I think, you know, the most psychotic, crazy thing we're watching on planet Earth is an effort to control the seed supply, to literally patent the seed supply so it can be under corporate control, and to entirely industrialize and centralize agriculture and food production and distribution. My guess is that the Gates Foundation is playing no small part in helping to do that. And I think that's because oil won't work to back a one-world virtual currency.
Yeah.
But control of the seed, water, and food supply will.
Now, she's concerned about agriculture. It seems to be the local level she works on. She helps farms and that. That's why she makes a big deal out of seeds.
No, Bob, if you control the seeds and patent the seeds, if you don't have any seed to sacrifice on the altar before the throne, you got no harvest. You'll be the richest man in the world, but you'll starve to death.
So the seeds are more important than oil?
A million times more.
And that's in the book of Revelations, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Okay, so... So she's spot on about emphasizing the seeds.
Well, they're just trying to make sure that the seeds are controlled within the currency.
Yeah, which is controlling it in the terms of the semantic limited printed version of wealth denomination. And
well, you know you're in trouble when you can't sing Happy Birthday anymore without paying somebody a right, a royalty.
Okay.
Well, hey, listen, I remember this story about the global seed vault up here in Svalbard, closer to where we are at least, and the Gates Foundation is one of the major contributors to that project, actually.
Right.
So,
right. Very amazing and interesting project, and I think anything we can bring, you know, do to bring transparency to what is happening, you know, would be good, and, you know, to me, seed banking is a very important thing for all of us to be doing.
You know, I've held this idea or theory that they're putting away the good genetic stock, so to speak, of seeds and bringing us the kind of Monsanto Terminator seed type of technology to us. And eventually, if something happens, climate changes on the planet or whatever have you, we're going to end up in a situation where we don't have access to seeds that have a good variety of genetics, meaning that they will die quickly and of course, terminate and will not continue. That's a major food problem right there.
Right. My bet on a lot of the philanthropic effort is really to support the industrialization of agriculture. There is a wonderful video that you can get on YouTube, and I have it up on my blog, of Charlie Rose of Bloomberg interviewing Sir James Goldsmith in 1994, and it's absolutely brilliant. You absolutely should get a copy of it and watch it. Sir James Goldsmith basically describes what's going to happen to agriculture with the World Trade Organization and the Uruguay Round of GATT passing, and what the implementation is going to do worldwide to agriculture and how incredibly insane the whole thing is.
Hmm.
And his brilliance in understanding what was going to happen and why and warning people was phenomenal. And that interview in 1994 is just as powerful and useful today as it was then. And I strongly recommend, because what it says is, what it tells you is, we know, we understand what we're doing. This is clear. This is a plan. And this is very, very dangerous.
Hmm. So where do you see Mr. Global taking America, financially speaking?
Well, Mr. Global, I think you need to look at it on a global basis. If you listen to Sir James Goldsmith and you look at everything that Mr. Global is doing, the only thing I can discern is Mr. Global plans on a much reduced population 20, 30, 40 years from now.
We do too.
You count on a less population?
You better believe it.
Well, what about when the Gulf is emptied and everybody spilled here?
Well, you ain't there yet. You hadn't even had the exodus yet.
Right. So you mean the exodus will reduce the population?
Well, you think?
I was just thinking, can you name who Mr. Global is today?
Mr. Global is an individual human creator coming into their power. There'll be lots of them. We'd say everyone can be Mr. Global in their world.
Right, and the Mr. Global who's holding the purse strings right now, he's actually in a weakened position. Yeah, so
right.
So that leaves room for everybody else to do their version of being Mr. Global.
That's
the standard
right.
Version doesn't work anymore.
Exactly, because you made it about the money, and what happens if the money's gone? Then you're nothing.
And there's lots of, you see this in the G8 and G20 meetings, you see the various short list of potential Mr. Globals panicking about their situation.
Absolutely. Queen can't even get her checks to clear.
Right.
And the, you know, how and why, the details of that, I have no idea. But if you look at the decisions that the American government started to make in 1995 and 96, a decision was made to literally pull all the capital out of the country, reinvest it in the emerging markets, particularly the BRIC nations, and to do that in a way that not only pulled all the capital that could be pulled legally, but pull a great deal illegally, and the way to do that politically was to pump and dump the economy with massive amounts of debt.
Hmm.
And I was part of a group in Washington that was trying to argue for a model that would not, that, you know, that would support the transition of the baby boomer and the American population for globalization and into a successful retirement. And as I watched the event unfold and what decisions were made, I could only presume that they were planning on a significantly reduced population here in North America. Their actions could only be compatible with that kind of estimate actuarially for the United States population. And I tried desperately through the late 90s and, well, you know, for the last 15 years to try and warn family, friends. And it was amazing. It was an amazing experience because literally there was almost no one who could fathom what I was trying to say.
Hmm.
They could not fathom. They could not fathom. Literally, the baby boomer population here in America could not fathom that their retirement savings and the resources behind governmental commitments to them was being moved out from under them, and they couldn't see it.
And I would say that her voice sounds tired because she's fighting a phantom. The Mr. Global who's designing these plans to undo the baby boomers and everything is no longer in that position to do that. That's what she's missing here. And it's actually great that everything was pulled away from everybody because now they can start really understanding what their power is and create their own dimensions of that power. So she sounds tired to me because she fought the good fight, but it was a Don Quixote action against a boogeyman that was rapidly tying itself up and offing itself. Would you agree with the words I've just said?
Yes, complaining about the bound strongman.
Yeah. Was that bound in heaven is bound on earth?
Mm-hmm. What's bound on earth is bound in heaven, yes.
I do want to ask you a little bit about what you think about the whole issue that taxpayers have been bailing out the bankers, and if there's something you can say about that, and also what you think the outcome of this will be, because what I'm seeing a little bit of here as well is that we might end up in a situation where the population are going to demand almost a more kind of socialist approach to how we deal with the banks. What do you think about that?
Well, what I think of this as a country leverage buyout. Okay, and when you do a leverage buyout, or what we call an LBO of a company, you tender to get control of that company, and once you have control, you use the company's cash to pay back the money you borrowed to take over the company. So you buy the company with its own resources. Okay, and it's called an LBO.
Right.
And what you've watched is an LBO of the United States, because massive amounts of fraudulent paper was issued during the 90s and early 2000. And that issuance wasn't an accident or incompetence or anything. There was massive intentional criminal fraud.
Now, Ian, that the intentions might have been that, but it didn't work out the way Mr. Goebel wanted. That's your point, isn't it, Ion?
No, China just made the dragon hungry.
Right. In other words, what she's talking about happened 80 years ago, in a way.
Started, yeah.
Yeah, and you've had replays of vacuuming since 80 years ago. You know, more intense or something.
And the point is, see, if they take over a country, they use those natural resources to pay back the money that they borrowed, but they did it the other way around. They already have
the Chinese did it backwards, and what'd they do?
They got the money already owned the debt,
yeah.
And now we'll want the resources out of the country to pay back the thing that they are owed.
And that's what Catherine's missing here.
Well, right. She's saying it's from a hostile takeover or leveraged buyout. Well, they've already done the leveraging. They've already owned, basically, instead of taking over the country, they already own all the debt. So it's their debt, so they have all the assets. So that's the point.
Yeah. To be aware of the illusion of the financial cover-up or print press effect, and fight against that and argue on that point is still to be back, like you could say, in the 19th century. You have to realize it's not even an issue, and she thinks it still is. The other thing is, when I first heard her back in 2002 or so, she had a great phrase, pump and dump, you know, national economies. And then she's saying here, LBO, whole countries. It's appropriate to talk on that huge level, because when you got Mr. Goebel does have the whole planet and all its resources, it's very tiny for him, it's a little town, and you do, the countries people think they're citizens of are little ephemeral furry pieces of lint that can be pumped and dumped and LBO'd, but you're still, she thinks that is working for Mr. Goebel.
No,
Ion's point is not, it's not working.
Right, well, what she's actually trying to get to is that that's what Mr. Goebel thinks is the answer.
Right.
And she's saying, if you ain't got any seeds, you can have all of it. We say this over and over and over. If you own the cattle of 1,000 hills, you shouldn't want for milk. But if you got nothing to feed those cows, they'll go dry.
Right. So I don't know if I made the point. I like the scale of her metaphors, you know, LBO country.
Yeah,
pump
very
and dump.
Good.
Because it puts... Everybody is in the satellite position looking at the globe, and that's what the internet gives you. You're bigger than the planet. You know, you have access to the
scan. We're just waiting to see what Mel Gibson's flatulence is going to hold for tomorrow.
Yeah, we're floating over the planet. We see this huge fart come out of L.A., and then we watch it ripple like in 2012 across the global chipscape and the TV landscape, and then it comes and goes. But to watch it from that position is still within the physical. We are bringing in the third phase with the non-physical factors from this lofty perspective.
Yes, indeed.
Right.
It was a plan. And I have written many stories to sort of document why I say that. But it was enormously profitable. And, of course, after the paper was all issued, then the question became, there's no, because you have all these fraudulent mortgages issued, where either they're mortgages issued for people who can't possibly pay the debt service, or on one home we've issued, you know, one mortgage and nine fraudulent mortgages on the same house. So you have all this phony baloney paper floating around, and once the debt service can't be supported, the question is what happens? Well, in 1989, the last time this happened, what happened was all the paper was allowed to come in and was worked out by a variety of methods, but that meant the files on the paper would transfer to third parties and their attorneys, and a variety of people could see those files. And it started to become a big joke in Washington because we would see a variety of firms get together and bid significantly more than the loans were worth. And what we started to believe was, well, they need to own the files because there's so much criminal liability in those files, they can't afford for anybody to see the files. They're willing to pay, let's say the mortgages are worth, you know, $2, they're willing to pay $3 because getting and destroying the files is worth another dollar to them.
Mm. Ion, she's talking about the later developments that she implemented back in the, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s with HUD 1, right? She's talking about the later. She's still talking about her expertise. She's applying her expertise to later developments in the of the 90s, right?
Well, it was the beginning. They did do that. They were. That's how the values kept increasing. They would bundle and discount the paper, but yet it was already more, way, way more than it was worth by half. You know, if it's worth $2, they'd pay $3 just to destroy it so they could continue making loans.
Right, but that, the her HUD-1 application that people have to fill out, she was cleaning up an earlier version of what she's describing right now in the later 90s?
Yes, very good,
yeah.
Within the dynamics of the URLA or the 1003.
Right.
So this time around, rather than let anybody see the files, what we've seen is basically the government has literally just cut massive checks, and the institutions, you know, the files have quietly gone away, remained under control of the, you know, the parties who did the fraud, whatever.
Yeah.
And so there's no, you know, there's zero transparency, and literally you're watching the nation cut a check to the people who engineered the fraud to buy up the nation.
Yes.
And so literally, it's an LBO of a country.
Hmm. And what will the outcome of that be? How will that affect people in the country?
Okay. So here's the key question. What's going to be her answer to the less than issue at this breakdown point where people don't have to feel less than, right? We're going to see what she says. That's what the meaning of that question is, right? Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's actually very pretty good questioning too.
Yeah.
Well, you now have it took from the Revolutionary War, 1776, until 3 years ago to accumulate $12 trillion of national debt. And then in the last year and a half, we incurred through the Fed or the Treasury another $12 trillion of debt to bail out the banks.
Hmm.
Now, one way to look at that system-wide is we took the entire savings of the baby boom generation and in a year and a half simply transferred it to the banks.
Hmm.
And so now what we have is a huge cohort of people who think they have pensions and 401ks and health care insurance from the government when they're 65, or now, you know, if they're on welfare. And what is a process is now going to begin through a variety of different mechanisms whereby, you know, they end up with one-tenth of what they thought they had 3 years ago.
Hmm.
And it won't necessarily be that clear or that visible to them in an explicit way, but I think intuitively they understand the gist of what's happening to them.
So she's saying there's a big, dark, inky mist, less than situation awaiting them. So I'm not for what she's, how she's assessing this, if I line up with Ion on this.
Oh, no. Yes, that's exactly what we say. It's wonderful. And then what happens?
No, she doesn't say it's wonderful.
Yeah, but we do. And what,
that's what I mean. That's what I'm lining up with. You saying this situation that's happened, the baby boomers, she's saying it's terrible. You're saying it's wonderful. See, there's a difference.
Because you have now no choice but to come into your place of power or expire.
Right.
What you're seeing around the country now is sort of an awakening of the sleeping giant, that this could really happen. For example, I remember once I was talking with someone in my family trying to warn them of this danger, and they said to me, oh, well, there's always been corruption. It's just the nature of the system. Because America traditionally has been very dependent on warfare and organized crime to both pool capital and exercise control of natural resources around the world. And so Americans are used to, you know, corruption being part of the system, but they've always thought of that system as protective of them and their rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they didn't understand, you know, and my theory was, look, when you go along with the system doing this level of harm to people worldwide, then at some point that machinery you build that feels comfortable harming people will come back and steal it from you.
Right, right. One thing I'd like to do here before we begin to run things off is take all of this in a little bit of a different detour, because we actually had one of our listeners contact us and who had heard you earlier this year on another radio program and wanted me to ask you a little bit about how about the idea that you found out about insider trading that pointed to the foreknowledge of the tsunami in Sumatra on Boxing Day back in 2004, and even the earthquakes in China back in 2006. Don't know if you want to just talk a little bit about that and how you found that out, because that is really interesting and has some huge implications, actually.
Well, I don't know other than what I experienced. What happened to me was a friend of mine wanted a World Bond Fund, and I'm not a big fan of World Bond Funds. And I spent a month researching different World Bond Funds and finally found two that kind of, you know, I was comfortable with. And they researched anyway. So they invested in one of them, and it had about 15% of the paper in Indonesian sovereign debt. And then right after they took a big position in it, overnight it dropped 15%. And there was no change in interest rates. There was nothing, there was no financial market reason, and we would call this, you know, they and I called the sponsor. We couldn't get any answers. No one would talk to us. It was just, we were being stonewalled. And it had all the patterns, as someone who's lived in the financial markets for decades, it just had the pattern. It was of massive insider selling on insider knowledge. And I was baffled. It was just one of the most baffling things that had ever happened. What in the world was this about? And then about a week after, the tsunami happened.
So Ion, did she create that tsunami with her perception of the shock that she...
Yep.
Because she's a powerful enough person to be that influential, so to speak?
Of course.
Right, so she caused that tsunami. It might be a surprise to her. But she wouldn't see that connection. Let's see if she says what it is.
And I'll never forget it. I've never been, as a financial person, as an investment person, I've never been as depressed in my life, because my gut reaction was they knew the tsunami was coming.
No. She's depressed because she caused it, but doesn't recognize that.
Right.
They knew. How could they have known?
They didn't know. They didn't know that she would interpret the World Fund corruption in such a negative way that would cause a tsunami. Correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
And I just, that's when I put together my first Solari Circle, and I said to everybody, we do it by bridge call once a week and, you know, help each other. We invest a little pool of capital together. And I said to the group when we gathered, I said, I cannot do this alone.
She didn't know that she was causing that, therefore she thought she couldn't do it alone. If she could do it alone if she knew that she had caused the tsunami.
Well, if she was good at it, she wouldn't have to do it for other people. She'd be so happy doing it for herself. She wouldn't have to have all that orgy business going on.
Right, that's why her voice sounds a bit tired.
I said, I cannot do this alone. I cannot do portfolio strategy in a world where people have foreknowledge of a tsunami hitting a country enough to affect its sovereign debt. Now, I have no proof that that's the case. You know, I could no more prove that in a court of law. It was just my gut reaction. You know, I've seen a lot of insider trading in my life and a lot of insider trading patterns, both as a regulator for the government and as a Wall Streeter.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's part of mapping the financial ecosystems. I mean, if you, I'll never forget when Paul Wellstone's plane was shot, or when he, you know, it was crashed. And if you look at the trading in the defense stocks, because his vote was the big block in the Arms Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at how the stock shot up. So again, this mapping your financial ecosystems will tell you a lot. And if you look at the financial patterns around a lot of these events, you know, you will see patterns that indicate or symptomatic of foreknowledge.
She's trying to figure out where to place the blame, right?
Yep.
She doesn't. It may not be as simple that she's the one to blame, but if she brought herself into it, then she might have more balance about perceiving other blameworthy entities.
Well, what she's playing out and doing is the things she's been talking about not doing for the last half hour.
Right. She started doing it herself. Because Mr. Global is trying to he's trying to position himself so he isn't blamed. But he thinks that the blame could be directed at him. Is that the way to say it?
Close enough.
Yeah, but you know, Mr. Global wants to get the power so he can determine where the blame goes, which is currency debt, which currency goes, which isn't. So power does involve only blame, and who gets to place the blame. That is power, and that's what both Catherine and Mr. Global are stuck in, this blame point.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that's not legal proof that foreknowledge exists, but it's, you know, in my world as an investment person, it's enough to give you the information you need to act, you know, in the real world, because we have to act with the knowledge that we have. So Dick Cheney once said the deficits don't matter, and he was right, because what you're seeing in America is you're seeing a global taxation system. America prints treasury securities and paper currency, and then countries buy it, and then it goes down in value,
mm-hmm.
or fraudulent securities.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've created is a global taxation system. The legislatures in different countries aren't voting to pay a tax and then paying it. It's happening through the balance sheet, so it never has to go through the legal process with any sovereign government. But we create paper that goes down in value and other people take it. And that's how the empire is financed. And it's simply a global taxation system.
Okay, so that's the end of the session with her, with Catherine Austin Fitz. The thing is, she would agree that maybe it's collapsed in on Mr. Global, but it sounds like, and many people who take a blame or look for a blame in some elite, Illuminati, alien, or your local mayor, don't recognize that outer world that you want to fix the blame on is really, really gone. But you might want to explain how there is an outer world. It doesn't have to impinge on you, but if we do have three kingdoms, so there is an outer world. But they're trying to put blame, they're trying to say the outer world is more influential on you than your middle kingdom or inner kingdom, something like that.
Well, the outcomes in her description would give them a higher level of credence, and
yeah.
You know better.
Okay, so personally, you take your own power. That is figuring out the relationship of the three kingdoms in yourself?
Yes, and when an outer kingdom experience comes into your environment, you know how to gauge and judge accordingly. But if you're not, then you're no different or better off than the ones who got hit by the tsunami after you lost your 15%. But she, her words at the tail, she was saying, I don't hold a great deal of authority. I don't do those. I don't say do them. But I had a client who wanted apparently a bunch of money, and 15% was in Indonesian rupee, and it fell. And then a week later, they had the tsunami. It's like somebody had the high sign, and we go, yeah, it was you, speaker. And but that's the point. Then it comes right back around from a marvelous, powerful creator saying, there's no way I could know, there's no way I could prove it, and then, the next thing showed up, and c'est la guerre.
To diminish the influence of the other kingdom, do you emphasize your inner kingdom?
You can.
But that is not desirable. You have to integrate the three somehow.
Well, not somehow. That's what shows up in your middle kingdom. It'll work out, come out watch day. You just got to be aware of what you're thinking and saying that's having effect on your global harmonic tetrad.
Right. So the inner kingdom contains emotions, but is the container is love as a force field. If you're having emotional reactions to the outer world, that's where you get tangled up. But you can use your love as a force field part of your inner kingdom to be align your outer kingdom purposes or intents or noticings.
Good.
And then that's shown in your middle kingdom. The resultant
shows up in your middle kingdom, right?
The output shows up in your kingdom, in your middle kingdom. We call it the output, the resultant.
That's what caught her in the butt.
The outer kingdom's outputs. She had an emotional reaction to it.
Yes.
But I'm asking if you can call the middle kingdom, which is the resolution of the inner and outer dialectic, what do you call that? A resultant now? An output now? A stabilized now?
That's all. Those are fine.
Yeah. Okay, so that was really good. That evoked very good abstractions from us.
Good.
I mean, this last Catherine Austin Fitz's participation, because she wasn't talking, when she did speculate about what could be, got into the questions about who or what, then she weakened, but she stayed just talking about what is.
Mm-hmm. And validating the is that you've been duped into some powerless conundrum.
Yeah.
And
so,
how to do it, and how to build the warhead so you can straighten them out if they get out of line.
And you suggest that one should not preoccupy themselves with that effort.
Right.
Well, we're the only radio show that takes the Blanche position and says, turn us off. Nobody goes that far. We're willing to be preempted and not show up because we weren't trying to tell you anything. So, Ed, it's come to the point, the decision of people's lives, it's the nitty-gritty. You either find it great to be alive or die.
Well, that's sort of been the process all along, has it not?
I guess the distractions and alibis that you're not doing that you're not committing suicide, have run their course and not available. So if you're looking for a reason, you're looking for an alibi to explain why you're going to check out.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people are already dead. They're just waiting on a disease to claim the body.
How many people on the, let's say 6 or 7 billion people here, how many would you say numerically are in the vibration of staying here and able to take the heat and the fun that's coming?
Well, if you listen to your last guest dossier, less than 1%, it'll grow. Because, see, the process is this thing is still happening, still being.
Yeah.
Once that being still is, you're going to find that the curve goes up. That's why we're never very definitive that this is going to be and that's less and this is going to work and that won't. No. That's why we're all excited that things are so what you call screwed up and less than that the only choice you got is to come into your place of power. That's the point that activates things. Nobody's going to cause a revolution if everybody's fat and happy.
Breakdown is potential breakthrough.
Yes, there is a Queen breakthrough song that's very significant.
Okay, Ed, I think we've come to a great ending. What do you think, Ed?
Very, very good.
Yeah, this is a opus epic performance tonight. And
yay.
You were very funny when you did one of the TV shows. I don't even know what it was. It was good. Do you remember, Ed?
Well, Conspiracy Theory.
Oh, yeah, the movie, Conspiracy Theory. That was really good.
Mm-hmm. It's great fun. Well, therefore, we do thank you all very much for your kind participation in listening to non-physical ramble babble. It was great fun. And we like the opportunity to be able to share and remind you to come back into the place of your power, which is where you're headed one way or the other anyway. So don't get uneasy about it. Let the rough side drag or jump in the middle of it and just hang on. That's the fun part. And as you keep moving forward in this whole place, the question answers will be questioned, as always. And as you keep continually come into your place of power, you have no choice but to know.
Very good. Well, then we are complete.
Therefore, we are totally, completely, deliciously, happily, forever incomplete.